morning and welcome to Town Square, our very first broadcast at 11 a.m. And we thank all of you for joining us today. As we always say, though, our conversations include you, and that part hasn't changed. You're welcome to join us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Near the end of Governor Ige's State of the State speech on January 23rd, Governor Ige prepped everyone for an adjustment to his budget. The change was based on a downward revision of the state's general fund tax revenue forecast, and last week he gave lawmakers his retooled budget. It sliced off about $220 million from the original biennial budget, and with the Council on Revenues meeting scheduled for March 13th, other adjustments may be necessary. Today, we'll talk with Governor Ige about his vision for our state and how it's evidenced in his revised budget and what may come next. And, of course, you're invited into this conversation at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Governor Ige, thank you so much for joining us on our very first broadcast at 11 a.m.
Thank you so much for the invitation. I'm really excited to be here. You know, I am an occasional listener of Hawaii Public Radio and the Town Square program, so I'm glad to be here.
Well, we thank you very much for the time, especially at this point in the year. Now, when we heard your original speech, you focused on, you know, four areas: transforming our schools, reshaping our economy, addressing homelessness and the building of more affordable homes, and government efficiency. As you then had to go back and retool the budget, and you knew you were going to have to do this because we'd already had that Council on Revenues projection with $155 million less, what did you do, and how was your thinking evidenced by the retooled budget?
I think that this is the first couple things, Beth Ann. This was the first budget that we built from the ground up. So this is clearly my budget for the first time. You know, the previous biennium budget is really started by the previous administration. So the good news is that our core values and priorities were built in from the ground up. And so everything in the budget is something that we embraced. I think it's really important to note that we did scale back the appropriations because the economy, well, the revenue is not doing as had been projected. But it still is focused and includes all of those things that are priorities for this administration. So what I told the cabinet and what I've told people is that what we're doing is maybe taking our foot off the accelerator a little bit because we're not getting the revenues that we thought, but we are still making those investments in those most important areas.
Because you built this budget from the ground up, and because you say that this really truly represents your vision for Hawaii, that would seem to have made it even more difficult for you to slice off some of these key areas. How did you decide to, for example, you know, bring down the weighted student formula appropriation, or this for charter schools to not have parity between charter schools and the per pupil amount for regular DOE students?
Well, certainly it was difficult, but education, and I really believe that investing in our people is still the number one priority. So the budget as presented to the legislature initially was the biggest increase in public education in at least the last several decades. So, yes, we had made education a priority. It received the lion's shares of funds that we had committed. And so necessarily it was scaled back, but it still makes an investment in the weighted student formula. And we are still advocating for innovation in public schools because we believe it is fundamentally important. And it really is. Innovation is something that we have committed to, you know, as an engineer myself and someone who has been in startups and gone through the venture capital program and created business and jobs. I truly understand how education and people and investment capital are all connected together, and the budget does represent that.
Because the budgeting process starts so early in the year, about May, when you're looking at something in the spring and we go through summer and fall and clearly there are changes and you're not delivering it until December and then telling everybody pretty much about it in January, and then there are continued meetings with the Council on Revenues, you know this already because you've been involved with this process for a very long time. Do you build in contingencies knowing that if this happens, then this is where we're going to pull? Did you know beforehand where you were going to have to slice if, in fact, things were a little different than you thought when you began the process?
Definitely, because I've been through the process on both ends, you know, as a legislator, very actively involved in what happens with the executive budget once it's introduced. I definitely had in mind how we wanted to build the budget, but also was very much aware and personally am involved with monitoring the revenues as it come in and seeing where the actuals are in relationship to the forecast. So definitely it was something that I was aware beginning in October and September probably, but you know, all indications when you talk to the economists and business people, all indications were that this was going to be another good year for the state. And we had expected that there would be a turnaround in the revenues. And so I think everyone in the business of forecasting the economy really has a hard time explaining why we are not seeing the increase in the general excise tax explicitly that all indications would have projected.
Precisely. One would have thought that that might have been increasing, but there have been other reasons that we've heard from economists that haven't, you know, hasn't exactly shown up. And in everything from the construction industry, but because knowing that those lovely cranes that we see out there in Honolulu and other places, well, all that was permitted quite a long time ago. And knowing that although we may be now at the very top of the good years, and we've heard from the University of Hawaii Economic Research Organization that 2015, 2016 was probably as good as it was going to get. And although we may hover now at that point just at the crest, there's going to be a downturn in how we begin to look at the coming years, because surely they're going to come. That's a cyclic thing. That is very much on the minds of lawmakers and everyone else, too, which brings me back to those of you listening. If you would like to get into this conversation with Governor Ige, who is here with us on our very first, dare we say it, inaugural venture at 11 o'clock in the morning, you can join us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We already have a caller for you, Governor. Dave Berlew calling us from Kahuku. And you're a farmer, Dave, as I understand?
Yes, I'm a farmer. I lease some farmland on Oahu in Punalu'u, and I'm one of the few farmers who are lucky enough to have the opportunity to live with my family on some private farmland in Kahuku as well.
Well, thank you for your commitment. Farmers are very important people in my list of priorities.
Oh, thank you so much. And that's one thing that was great to hear, that you have, you know, food sustainability goals. And I just want to let you know there's definitely plenty of farmers who are already committed to that as well and ready to step up to the plate. So I just wanted to suggest what would really get us on track is investing in the infrastructure. The biggest challenge we have farming here is, can we afford to grow certain products? And that's where we fall short, and why we are, you know, why we import so much food from the mainland, and that is because, you know, there's large-scale industrial farms that are able to produce food a lot cheaper, and they kind of cut us out of the loop because of that. So if there were investment in infrastructure, meaning, you know, marshalling areas where farmers could collectively process our foods and, you know, as well as reliable sources of water and even, you know, labor development to help us have reliable labor, that's definitely some steps that would move many farmers in the direction of meeting those goals.
Dave, before the governor answers you about some of that stuff, I just wanted to ask you, though, isn't this also part of a larger conversation of what is it that we can be growing, what we should be growing, what is the in the best interest of the state as a whole, and not necessarily can we grow absolutely everything that we want that you might be able to get, for example, you know, at Costco because it's coming in from the mainland?
Ah, correct. Absolutely. Yeah, there's so much opportunity to be able to just to produce in general, just to being able to bring down the costs of production, then we'd have a diversity of farmers able to grow a diversity of things. That'll
right.
fall into place. Everybody will find what they're able to grow and start producing.
Okay, let me get you an answer from the governor. And thank you very much for calling. Glad you're listening.
Sure.
Governor.
Thank you. Yeah. We definitely know, and the budget that is before the legislature does make investments in two critical parts. The Department of Agriculture is very much aware that we are transitioning from focused support on big industrial agriculture and seeing what kinds of programs are necessary to support the smaller farmers, the family farmers. And so this budget does include a couple things. And Bethann, I just wanted to emphasize that even though the operating budget is constrained a little bit and we're expecting less GET and general fund appropriations, we do believe it's important and have maintained the capital side of the budget. So there were no reductions to our capital budget submission to the legislature. We do believe that from a timing perspective, it's important that we move forward with state infrastructure projects, and we want to assure and try to maintain the construction industry with government-funded projects. So we do have a couple initiatives that respond directly. We are making investments in the infrastructure and water availability. You know, we are supporting and have funds available to develop reservoirs and water systems that support farmers. And then there is a request. We know that the small farmers have to get supported differently. And so a food processing facility, support for food safety and security guidelines, trying to create a centralized processing facilities that smaller farmers, yeah, kitchens and
commercial kitchen,
right? The production side, we know that part of the challenge is besides the fresh produce and fresh sales, trying to support processing, canning, those kinds of activities to create different kinds of revenue streams for the small farmers are part of that. So. Definitely the budget in front of the legislature makes those kinds of investments because we know that it's a different kind of support that small farmers need.
When you consider your vision for the state and how the state is developing and will continue to develop well after the time that you have been shepherding it, what place does rail play in the state, and what do you think the state's commitment to rail should really be?
I am a big supporter of transit, and I do know that it's a quality of life issue, and I know that when I travel, I find the quality of life higher in those communities that have very well-defined transit systems. So. You know, at the core, I truly believe that transit is good for our community. The challenge is really what kind of system can we afford and how do we pay for it? And my sense in talking with legislators and the mayor and others is that there is a common commitment to moving the project forward. I think the question is, how do we pay for it? And do we need to scale back the project so that it can become something that we can afford and is sustainable going forward.
Rail doesn't exist in a vacuum, though. I mean, rail is intrinsically listed in the ideas that we've had to develop homes, develop units that people can afford, whether they're rentals or whether they are, you know, for purchase. How do we take something that's so inextricably linked to that and look at it outside of it when all of this is so interdependent?
Right. Well, so in our budget, we support both. We do know that on Oahu, development of affordable housing and further housing development is inextricably linked at this point to rail. You know, as the public policy has driven, you know, we are trying to keep the country, and so no development on the windward side or the North Shore, that really does drive development into West Kapolei, you know, and we will have to see the transit system completed because the rest of the development really is in the urban core. We have a planning. We have two different projects that are supporting better planning in the urban core. You know, our Kalihi 21st century effort is really looking at that Kalihi area and the state properties and how can we re-envision and redevelop Kalihi in a way that our community can embrace it. And we have an interagency transit-oriented development effort that is getting all the state players together and looking at the state parcels along the transit and what can be made available for housing and other kinds of things. And I think it's important, Bethann, to remember that it's more than just the housing. The transit system allows you to re-envision Honolulu differently.
Communities.
Right. And we are also talking about, okay, what kinds of facilities should be located along the transit line that would build better communities. So schools, should there be a school adjacent to the transit line? How do we make higher education more accessible? And we are fortunate that West Oahu and Leeward Community College and Honolulu Community College are right adjacent to the rail line, and it gives us a different opportunity to look at those campuses and what it could do. And for those of us who, and I lived all my life on the west side and had to drive through the traffic to get into town every day, we know that when the university is not in session, traffic is immensely better. And so how do we make appropriate investments in higher education along the transit line? How do we locate the other services that our community needs? How do we make our community more livable and have a better quality of life by rethinking how we build our city?
And to some of those points, we have a shy caller. But before we get to what the shy caller wants to know, I just wanted to ask you point blank, is there any thought in your mind that rail will not go all the way into town to Alawana?
We definitely need to figure out where it has to go to. It has to come into town. Whether it goes all the way to Alamoana, I think that's something that we can talk about, but it definitely needs to go beyond Middle Street. It really is looking at what the sources of revenues and funds we would have and how much can we afford. I think that's very important.
On the subject, Shy Caller Howard said that, have you taken into account the effects of rail construction on the businesses? He says, you know, revenues from what he believes have gone down. Tax collection has gone down, too. Why focus on rail when local infrastructure has been so bad, water main breaks, et cetera?
We do know that we need to do both. We need to make investments in infrastructure to keep our city vibrant. At the same time, traffic and transportation is just a huge challenge, especially for those who live on the west side, and the bulk of the jobs are really in Honolulu. So I think we need to look at both of those options. And as we've talked about affordable housing and tried to look at what the state can do to help with rentals and help support development, we know that the core infrastructure, water and sewer, is has to be invested in and developed at the same time we look at these opportunities.
We've got lots of callers on the line. We're going to go off now to Chris calling us from Haleiwa, who has an issue about homelessness, saying that the state recently completed a three-year study about illegal vacation rentals, 20% of housing on Oahu. Heard the news that you favored making these rentals legal. The issues with Airbnb, as we've heard for the last couple of sessions, really wants to talk about the impact of that on the homeless situation. Chris, are you joining us? Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Aloha. Welcome to Town Square.
Aloha, Chris.
Aloha. Yeah, in addition, as well as the homeless issue, this also does affect the tax issue as well, because not only is Airbnb not collecting the taxes, and nor is the state collecting the taxes for these illegal rentals, but also when these are not residences, everything, all of the work and all of the maintenance, everything purchased for these homes becomes a business expense and then is a write-off and is not being taxed by the state as well.
I just wanted to clarify that I do not support illegal rentals or expansion. What I said in my veto message of the bill to collect the taxes last year was that I believe that the bill that was presented to me that would facilitate tax collection was too focused on just collecting the state obligation and the taxes that are due to the state, and would have facilitated more illegal rentals, which was the problem that I had. So I do believe that we need to collect the taxes that are owed from these individuals. I do believe we need to create transparency so that we can enforce county ordinances and ensure that any property that is rented is appropriate in that for the land use that's designated. And those are the two things that I think need to go hand in hand in order for us to move our community forward.
Thank you, Chris, for the phone call. We have David now calling us from Hilo, who is asking a question that I know that you hear a great deal. Tourism is very high now. We've seen record numbers, may see record numbers again. And, of course, that adds a lot of pressure to our environment to be able to cope with it. We've really never had a truly open discussion about what is the carrying capacity of Hawaii, how many people do we want to invite to come here at any one time, how can we really cope with this without having it be borne on the backs of the counties or on the backs of residents in those counties, but especially for those people who are deeply concerned about the effect on the environment. David wants to talk to you now from Hilo. Aloha. Welcome to Town Square.
Hey, aloha. Yeah, thanks for having me on. And thank you, Governor, for taking my call.
Certainly.
My question is I'm originally from Kailua on Oahu, and I noticed that, you know, over the years, because I've been living in Hilo for about 20 years, when I go back, things have just seemed to change and change and change. And I want to know what's being addressed, like the beachfront properties and the congestion and the added pressures on the environment from, you know, the growing tourism numbers. Is there, like, anything being taken to address these concerns?
I do believe that the current land use and zoning processes limits expansion of tourism and the visitor industry. You know, they're not a whole lot of projects that have been approved for hotel development on a going forward basis. So, you know, as governor, when I look at our economy, I do know that we're not going to see significant growth in the visitor industry going forward. There's just not a whole lot of areas. Right. There's not a whole lot of areas that are zoned for resort development that are, you know, there's just like on Oahu, it's just really maybe one more hotel in Turtle Bay. There are a couple of places in Ko'olina, but there really isn't a lot of land that has been authorized for hotel development. So we know that it's not growing. So whether it's a natural kind of response, or we do know that growth in the visitor industry is slowing significantly, and there will only be a limited growth going forward. So we are already seeing that slowdown or reduction. And so we are focused on how to make better investments in infrastructure, trying to recognize that many of the visitors who come to Hawaii now are already repeat visitors. And how can we make investments in core infrastructure that benefits the local residents? At that same time, it may make some areas more accessible to visitors. And I think it really is a balancing act. You know, we need to make investments in infrastructure that benefits our community, and it will help us carry more visitors at the same time.
Thank you for the call, David. If you'd like to join us for our very first broadcast at 11 a.m. in the 11 o'clock to noon hour, you can join us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Joining us for our very first broadcast, Governor David Ige. When you look at the situation regarding medical marijuana and how long it took us to get to the point where we have dispensaries, really looking at what happens now is we have some bills are looking at decriminalizing it, moving in that direction. Some people have said, you know, well, we're going to wait and see. We've had a lot of wait and see, and there have been a lot of our listeners who have been asking questions about that, including now one from Kevin in the Big Island. Kevin, are you there?
Aloha.
Aloha. Aloha.
Thank you, Governor Ige, for your time. I really am looking forward to where your leadership will take our state.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. So my question is, what do you see the role of recreational marijuana playing and you know, in parallel with what the state of Colorado has been doing, where they've been able to plug the budget shortfalls with the tax revenue? I know they tax recreational marijuana very heavily at around 25%, and they've been investing a lot of that money into schools, education for their keiki, so that they've actually brought down the use of marijuana in their the children under 18 or so, or under 21 even. So I was just wondering what you see the role of recreational marijuana in the future of Hawaii.
Certainly. What my view of it is that we need to be careful about how we expand in this area. You know, many of my department heads have been very active as we've been implementing the dispensary law, and we've reached out and we've talked with many public officials in Colorado and Oregon, Washington, trying to get the best practices and best advice that we can from many government officials. And what we have heard from many of them is that it's better to be careful and better to be thoughtful in how we expand medical marijuana or the, taking the next step to recreational, because there are unintended consequences, and planning and anticipating them would serve the public better. And so that's the approach that we're taking. We are very much engaged with many of the officials that are implementing the laws in the other states, and so we have learned tremendously from them. I do know that there is revenue opportunities in recreational marijuana and others, but the caution that we keep hearing from many is that you have to be careful about how you do it, and that good planning really does reduce the unintended consequences, which is what we would want to be able to do.
You mentioned that you've been checking in with other states, and in pretty soon you're going to go off and meet with governors from other states in a very, very changed political climate. How do you see your role in the complement of governors with whom you will meet, given the fact that Hawaii is a bluer-than-blue state, and we say that we have certain values, certain ways of being, things that we cherish, the diversity of our population that doesn't seem to be in sync with what's happening in Washington and in many states throughout the nation?
I'm excited about the opportunity to go to Washington, D.C. and National Governors Association. But to me, it really is a continuation of something that I saw shortly after taking office as governor. I really see this as an opportunity for states to lead. You know, I'm proud that I represent the people of the state of Hawaii. I am so proud of the sense of community in Hawaii as I've gone around the state to campaign, but just to meet in town meetings and working through various projects. Our community has a broader sense and is not so self-centered. And that's something that I'm very proud of. You know, there is no other community in the United States or the world, for that matter, that represents the diversity that Hawaii represents. And I think most importantly, there is a intrinsic value that all of us who choose to call Hawaii home have and recognize that there is a broader sense of community, and what I do individually impacts the broader community, and so people are very much aware. So we learned a long time ago that we can do great things when we work together. There is a sense that we can collaborate, and it's important for us to understand what decisions and how decisions impact individuals differently, and that we ought to be aware of what those impacts are and find ways to mitigate and reduce the impact on those who are impacted.
You talk about the opportunity for states to lead now. Certainly one area in which that's showing up is in education with the Every Student Succeeds Act, ESSA, which replaced No Child Left Behind, much to the relief of a lot of educators and school systems throughout the nation. But as you see that playing out in Hawaii, and this goes back to the idea of innovation and going back to changing the school system into one that is going to meet a need that we don't yet really understand, except to say that there's a certain way of thinking or being that you can teach a student how to think a little differently, how to approach problem solving a little differently, how to work collaboratively in ways that we haven't yet done, that becomes the sort of, you know, the behavioral part of it to approach all of that. How do you see that playing out with your ideas of innovation? I know you were at the educational conference earlier in the year where we were talking about school empowerment and walking around from table to table to table in a room full of educators who were just, you know, spitballing ideas that might be a way of being able to bring innovation into the school cheaply. And, you know, of course, the issue about having the innovation grants. What happens to that now?
Well, the thing that at last year at the National Governors Association, I was fortunate enough to have some time to talk with Senator Lamar Alexander from Tennessee. And, you know, he is one of the few people that I know personally that served as governor, was very much involved with education in that capacity, and was one of the leaders in changing education in Tennessee, and then became a senator and was the author of the Every Student Succeeds Act. And so we talked a lot about different things, and he truly had intended, as part of the Congress, that the Every Student Succeeds Act would return to the states authority for them to make the most important decisions. And his suggestion to me was that I not wait for government regulations, especially from the federal side, because in his work, he was truly committed as the U.S. senator to return as much authority as he could to the states. And so he had suggested that, you know, it really is an opportunity for us to re-envision what public education would be, and that he would be working from the Congress to empower states as much as he could. So with that, we started this whole process, and we did the Education Summit the first time in decades that we invited people to participate. We had more than 1,000 people show up, and through our town meetings and talking about the blueprint for education, we've engaged more than 3,000 people all across the state to talk about that. And so I will continue to move the ball forward at the state level. You know, we have been talking in the governor's team on Every Student Succeeds Act and asked the question about whether we should wait. And there was unanimous consensus that we would move forward. Our approach is going to be, let's define the blueprint and the vision and the pathway that the state wants to pursue, and then we'll make adjustments as necessary once the federal policy is established. But it was definitely helpful for me to be able to have the conversation with Senator Alexander, because he definitely will be involved.
Still under sort of the umbrella of states leading and what we could do. We have an issue that's resurged a couple of times. It's back again this year in front of the legislature, the Death with Dignity bill. And looking at how you have been watching this happen, because this is not the first time by any means. This has been going on for decades, you know, back to the days of Aquan McElrath and Bud Smizer and others who have been trying to push that. And now we have a bill that seems to still be very much alive. If it gets to your desk, would you be willing to sign it?
Yes, most definitely. You know, the Death with Dignity issue has been around for several years, and it certainly has been one of the most difficult, I think, because of the people on both sides of the issue who are so passionate and have so many compelling stories to tell from their different perspective. You know, Beth Ann, one of the things that moved me when the issue was before the legislature before was really the depth and passion of those individuals on both sides of the issue who came before the legislature and argued their position for and against, and the quality of the conversation that resulted. It was definitely one of the most difficult decisions that I've dealt with as a legislator for such a long time. As I said, I think part of it was due to the quality of people and the quality of the testimony and the personal nature on both sides that that came before the legislature. And as you know, the previous bill died because of a single vote. I mean, it was really one of those that all of the senators voted their conscience, and at the end there wasn't a consensus to move forward. I do think that there has been lots of progress in different ways. As you know, several states have expanded and embraced the notion. I anticipate that there will be still a difficult decision that the legislature will make, but I believe that there will be a proposal that I will be able to support.
All right. I want to talk to you a little bit more about the issue of homelessness, because you have been moving that along over the last 18 months or so. We've seen some different initiatives. But as you look at Housing First, We have a question from a shy caller who wants to know how committed you are to getting the thousands of Native Hawaiians off the DHHL list and how that will dovetail with housing first, homelessness, and beyond that, too, with our responsibility to COFA migrants.
Thank you very much for that question. We are committed to those chronically homeless and moving them into permanent housing. The real focus and what has been successful and what has been embraced in the Housing First program is really a focus on placing people in permanent supportive housing in an environment that gives them the best opportunity to be successful, to resettle themselves and get them into a permanent housing situation which they can be supported in. I'm totally committed to that effort. We've, over the last 18 months, really been looking at the state programs and how we can structure the contracts to really be focused on those most important outcomes. And the most important outcome was really placement in permanent housing. So for the same amount of money, $12 to $13 million, the new contracts will, if the providers are successful, will double the number of placements from 3,000 to more than 6,200. And I think that that will allow us to make progress in getting people off of the streets and into housing. I do know that Native Hawaiians are overrepresented in those who are homeless, and definitely we are working at Department of Hawaiian Homelands to accelerate those development of housing for Native Hawaiians. We are building a more comprehensive focus. You know, what Joby and the leadership at Hawaiian Homelands have been focused on is trying to assure that there is an array of financing options. You know, we know that many on the list have been offered a lease on residential property and are unable to accept it. And it could be because they don't have the financial wherewithal. And so we are looking at different kinds of options. You know, for the first time, we're looking at affordable rentals and trying to provide rental assistance. We are trying to create a program for rent to own so that we can get a Native Hawaiian into a rental program and that their rents can work to get them into that position. And then we are looking at various financing efforts, you know, build your own or assisted financing issues, because that is the biggest challenge to getting a Native Hawaiian into a better residential situation.
Well, we're talking about residential challenges. Henry, calling us from Manoa, wants to talk to you about housing for professors at UH. Aloha, Henry. Welcome to Town Square, and thank you for your patience.
Aloha. I got a question for the governor. Governor, you never mentioned anything about the University of Hawaii and housing. If you look around the country, what's happened to some areas such as Silicon Valley, the cost of housing has gone up so high that the university is not going to attract the best and the brightest here. This university is the one of 77 land-grant research universities around the country, and these people are going to go elsewhere if they can't find a place to live, a decent place to live. So why not look into what you can do for people that to come here? If you don't do this, we're in the future, we won't have a UH won't be around.
All right, Henry, let me get you an answer.
Thank you very much for that, Henry. I did support efforts in the past for faculty housing at Manoa. I know that they have completed a couple of projects. I do know that it is an ongoing concern, and I was gratified to see that redevelopment close to the university down on University Avenue and King Street is finally getting started. And, you know, I have had conversations with President Lesner, and definitely faculty housing is one of the challenges that he has. So, you know, I look forward to working with the Board of Regents and President Lesner to try and see what lands. We do have lands that can be made available. And I think that we recognize that if we cannot have housing to offer to some of the faculty members, that they might not be able to come here.
When we look at the general plan for Hawaii, when you look out over the next 25, even 50 years, what kind of vision do you see moving us forward besides the smaller visions that are now encompassed in some of these individual bills or some of the issues that we've talked about? Because they all, I mean, there's confluence there, particularly when you're talking about affordable housing and homelessness and transit and all of that. Even, you know, the fact that we have libraries that are becoming central places for, you know, people who aren't working, who are homeless, who are trying to find information, they're going there. And that wasn't necessarily the original intent of a library. Libraries at school for children in the same way that are being affected. How do you see this state being able to be that beacon that we, you know, frequently talk about in an offhanded way, but really to be able to evidence that? If you and I were to talk to each other 25 years from now, which I hope we will, what do you want to say was done of Hawaii or for Hawaii in your tenure in the big picture?
I really do think that it's about beginning the community conversation about priorities and making choices. We have made a big effort to focus more on long-range planning throughout all of the responsibilities of the state. You know, Leo Assumption, who's the director of the Office of State Planning, has initiated, and actually the very first revision of the state functional plans is the housing plan. It just came across my desk yesterday and really talks about how we envision supporting development of housing, the state's role in affordable housing, and most importantly, affordable rentals. So I think that the big picture that we are focused moving forward, you know, it's funny, the First Lady Dawn was working on a speech at Lincoln Elementary School, Eva Elementary School, for the Lincoln Day festivities, and she came across this quote from Abraham Lincoln, the best way to predict the future is to create it. Something like that, I'm paraphrasing. But I really think that that's part of the opportunity that we have. We need to, as a community, engage in what that vision looks like. I'm willing and happy to share what I believe. It really is about investing in our people. It's education. It's about innovation and stop looking for someone else to do it. It really is about collectively, as a community, we need to decide what our future should be and then work to create it.
In that vein, there are many who are still wondering about the TMT and looking at, well, what does this mean for us as a community? What are we going to create? What is the role of science? And we've certainly talked about trying to shore up STEM or bring STEM more into education, and others who are saying, why are we only focusing on that as opposed to a wholly integrated situation? But going back to the issue of TMT, Gary is calling us from Kaneohe and has a specific question for you.
Sure.
Hi, Governor. Thank you for making yourself available for this. And before I get to my question, I'd like to compliment you on your willingness to discuss all matters in this forum. And I think a lot of people sell you short. You definitely have a very good grasp of many issues and all of the complexities, so we appreciate that. Now, to TMT, I'm a very, I guess, strong fan and proponent of both astronomy and space exploration and all that relates to it. And I support the TMT. And I also, you know, really believe that the Hawaiian community that call themselves the protectors come from a people who fundamentally were explorers and were very, I think, strong proponents of science and understanding nature themselves. So I really believe that had the Hawaiians been left to develop in isolation, it wouldn't have happened. But had they would probably be the kahunas, and the kahunas of old today would very strongly be in favor of understanding the universe themselves. And
Gary, forgive me for interrupting you, but Gary, hang on a second. We're really having a difficult time hearing you, so forgive me for cutting in, but I'm going to ask the governor to comment on your real question about the TMT. Where are we going from here?
Certainly, as you know, the Supreme Court had stated that they believe the land board had erred in their taking action on approving the permit and had asked the land board to go through a contested case. And that's where we are today. The land board is considering the permit that would allow the 30-meter telescope to proceed. I am a supporter of the 30-meter telescope project. I do believe that it's an important strategic asset that the state has. And most importantly, I do believe that we can do it in a way that is consistent and honors the cultural and traditional practices of Native Hawaiians. And so we'll see what happens before the land board. But certainly it is a project that I personally support.
Is there something that you think that in all of the conversation we've been having about this legislative session that we haven't focused on enough? I know there wasn't a whole lot that you called out in your State of the State speech this time around about elders, about kupuna, yet we've got a bill that would fund, you know, family caregivers to the tune of about $70 a day, but that would have to come from an appropriation. I wanted to ask you about how you felt about that bill, and also if that's not the answer, is there another answer, another solution that you see in being able to fund that for people who are clearly in a bind, trying to raise a family, trying to take care of elders? We've got the longest lived population, I think, of any of the states. We say that we appreciate our families and that we want to care for them. And we have been pushing this idea of aging in place for such a long time now that it's taken root, only there's not the money to help those stay in place. And we're certainly not going to get any more beds.
Well, we have made tremendous progress in the last couple years, and I was proud to be part of those in the legislature who supported increased funding for kupuna care, and this budget in front of the legislature now doubles the amount of funds to more than $8 million to support kupuna care. And we do know that the demographics is a tsunami. It's often been described
it
right that way, and there is so much need. And we are seeing more investment, baseline investment, to support for kupuna care and aging in place, and the ADRCs to help people navigate the many issues, I think, have been established, and we continue to help facilitate people aging in place. I've been encouraged by the number of assisted living facilities that have come up in our community. You know, the Plaza is now in Pearl City, my hometown, and on the edge of Waikiki, and a whole lot of other places. So I think we are making progress in how we can support our kupuna and aging in place. Definitely there is still more to be done. And you know, it's funny, somebody had asked me in the state of state, why didn't I talk about elderly issues? And it's just because we only try to program a speech that people can sit through, and it's really 40 minutes. And
not because it wasn't important.
Right.
Okay, so but one of the things that's very important to people, not just elders, is health care. And now we are in a time of a very huge question mark as what will happen. And yet Hawaii was leading this, as you know, because you've been here your whole life, that we were out there at the forefront with prepaid health care. What happens now, as you see it, that puts this back in alignment for Hawaii, regardless in some ways of what may be happening in Washington?
I certainly, one of the sessions at the National Governors Association is specifically on the Affordable Care Act, and we are supposed to have a session with the congressional leaders. So I will be, if asked, telling the story about Hawaii and our success with the Hawaii Prepaid Health Care Act, and making sure that they understand that it's been the law of Hawaii for more than 40 years, and it's served us well. So, you know, my advocacy will be to make sure that whatever the Congress does in terms of health care, it doesn't impact what we've done here in Hawaii. And I definitely will be talking about the fact that Hawaii is the healthiest state in the country. We have the longest longevity of anywhere by far. We have lower insurance premiums for equivalent coverage than any place else in the country because we cover so many of our community, and we have the lowest per capita Medicare costs. So our investment in ensuring that people have access to health care for most of their lives saves the country money.
And for Medicare and Medicaid.
And Medicare and Medicaid. And what I will be talking about is what Hawaii has done under the Affordable Care Act. And what that has allowed us to cover now virtually everyone in our community, and what the impact for changes would be, and making sure that the Congress understands that many in our community, all across the country and specifically in the state of Hawaii, have benefited from the Affordable Care Act, and that we will remind them to be thoughtful, that it's not just a political. We have real people being helped. The migrants from the Kofa Nations and others who are getting access to health care that they would not have had otherwise.
Which seems to go back to the conversation of what can Hawaii do within the situation we find ourselves and the political climate in which we find ourselves. Where is it that Hawaii can lead? Do you see this as being a clear area where Hawaii and its congressional delegation can put the spotlight on Hawaii in a way that it perhaps would be even more meaningful now?
I certainly will be, and I've been talking with the congressional delegation and getting advice from them and sharing. And so certainly I will be going to Washington to talk about what has worked and about the fact that we have had success for more than 40 years with our policy that people should have access to quality health care.
Governor, I want to thank you so much for spending the last hour with me. Will you come back?
Absolutely. This was fun.
We'll look forward to it. And thank you very much to all the people on the line. And sorry we couldn't get all the questions through. But, you know, that's kind of how it happens when you sit down and have a conversation. We're glad that you were able to join us for this one on our inaugural venture into the 11 o'clock hour with Governor David Ige. This will be rebroadcast, if you've missed any part of it, tonight at 7 o'clock. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you next week for Town Square at 11 and back at 11 tomorrow morning for The Conversation. Aloha.